Penguin Random House Audio presents The Great Stewardess Rebellion, How Women Launched a Workplace Revolution at 30,000 Feet by Nell McShane Wolfhart. Read for you by Bonnie Friel. Introduction. This morning, sightseeing in New York. And in about 5 hours, I'll meet my date for dinner in San Francisco. Thus read a 1961 newspaper ad for American Airlines that enticed would-be stewardesses with the glamour of life as a sky girl. It was this alluring image of a cosmopolitan career that would take you to new places, introduce you to new people, and confer upon you an aura of beauty, confidence, and desirability that snared the imagination of young women in small towns, farms, and cities all over the United States. They wanted to escape lives that were mundane and ordinary, and becoming a stewardess seemed like an unmissable chance to do just that. The opportunity to embody the stewardess ideal, slim-hipped, smiling, perfectly coiffed, and spend your time serving cocktails to Don Draper types, while wearing an Emilio Pucci-designed uniform, was irresistible to tens of thousands of young women. But underneath this glossy surface, the reality of the job was very different. Appearance standards mandated that the women working the cabin adhere to strict weight limits, that they be physically inspected to be sure they were wearing girdles, that they have clear complexions, perfect eyesight, even teeth, no scars, and be, as often as possible, white. It wouldn't be much of an exaggeration to say that in the 1960s, the airplane cabin was the most sexist workplace in America. Stewardesses were required to be unmarried, a demand the airline stuck to perversely well after nearly every other industry had dropped this rule. Once they hit their 32nd, 33rd, or in some cases, 35th birthday, they'd lose their jobs. And if they became pregnant, they'd be fired immediately. Virtually no one became a stewardess thinking they'd make it their life's work. And it would have continued to be that way if they hadn't taken matters into their own hands. This is the story of how that happened. It's about how Pat, a 19-year-old from Missouri whose biggest ambition was to become a stewardess supervisor, would spearhead a workers' rebellion, leading a subversive campaign to undermine one of the largest and most powerful groups in organized labor. It's about how Tommy, a rangy Texas stewardess with a sociology degree, would help run a feminist organization that made headlines time and time again, and how she'd invest heart and soul in seizing institutional power to change her industry from the inside. And it's about how the work of the stewardesses in striking down the airline industry's most sexist rules was helped along by Sonia, a single-minded Jewish refugee from Germany who would end up making legal history in more ways than one. Their friends and colleagues aided and abetted them through court cases, face-offs with airline executives, sexual harassment, picketing, intimidation from labor bosses, and internal struggles. Through women's marches and weight checks, from hot pants to organizing campaigns, their efforts, not always unified, but with the same goals in mind, resulted in a workplace revolution. Their actions changed their own industry forever, and along with it, the lives of women workers in the United States. They were among the first to see the potential of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to fight sex discrimination. They launched a series of complaints with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, then dozens of lawsuits, in a drive to eradicate marriage, pregnancy, and age bans in the cabin. They lost more often than they won. The airline industry was highly dedicated to keeping its workforce young, thin, single, and female. But their work turned Title VII into a tool that would be wielded against discriminatory employers for decades to come, helping to cement the rules of law on disparate treatment based on sex, and establishing case law that would go on to benefit all working women. When they had, after hard-fought battles, succeeded in turning flight attendant from a carefree interlude between college and marriage into a career that could span decades, it suddenly became exponentially more important that the conditions of that work, low pay, weight limits, degrading uniforms, were in every way inferior to those of their male colleagues. So they used their seductive image to their advantage, bringing public attention to the sexist standards of their workplace and to the way their employers had created and then exploited a stewardess as sex object trope to sell plane tickets. Stewardesses enjoyed a unique cultural visibility, but that had its dark side. The glamour of the job was offered up in place of tangible benefits such as retirement plans, maternity leave, a living wage, and much more. Turning to their union for help, they found little forthcoming from the men in charge. So they decided to seize that power for themselves, looking to homegrown leaders who would take the radical step of breaking away from an extremely powerful labor organization to form their own women-led union. Flight attendants might seem like unlikely figureheads of the women's movement. It's hard to view them as the militant union leaders, passionate organizers, or aggressive litigators they were. It was all too easy to underestimate them, something that was quickly discovered by the very people they were fighting. The airline executives, who forced them into paper dresses and go-go boots, and the unions, that treated them as decorative mascots rather than workers or colleagues. The flight attendants' achievements are, even from today's perspective, remarkable. They forced the airlines to promote them alongside men, to pay them fairly, to treat them as legitimate workers. The Stewardess Rebellion is a story of harnessing the energy of the women's movement to make radical change. It's a story of seizing power from the powerful. And for Pat and Tommy and many of their friends, it's a story of unexpected personal transformation. But the flight attendants' biggest victories were only achieved through tenacious collective action and through behavior that was anything but ladylike. Part 1. Pat. Chapter 1. Honeybuns on the Charm Farm. Pat Gibbs became a stewardess to get away from her mother. Gracie Gibbs was a showboat, the best-known person in Springfield, Missouri. She had 6 children and a thirst for fame. When she and her husband started working at Sifferman's, a local appliance store, black and white televisions were making their first appearance on the shelves. Gracie, who had an air of glamour and an endless belief in her own abilities, convinced the owner to let her star in his commercials, and she soon became known as the face of Sifferman's. When she and Pat's father, Bob, opened their own store, Appliances by Gracie, TV stations, still new, were in need of content. Gracie launched her own talk show, Gracie's Good Neighbor. Local musical talent performed, Brenda Lee, Tennessee Ernie Ford, and other eventually famous singers, between interview segments and beautiful baby contests. As far as Springfield went, Gracie was a star. Pat, who was second eldest, and her 5 brothers and sisters all made appearances. Though Gracie wouldn't let them hold a script, they were expected to remember all their lines. Pat tried her best on the show, but she never felt that she was quite what her mother had expected to get when she had a daughter. Her mother bought her ballet lessons. Pat traded them for trampoline classes. Pat asked for Western gear as a Christmas gift to wear to horse shows. Instead, she got modeling lessons. And while her mother's fame eased the family's money stresses, being known as Gracie's daughter wasn't what Pat had in mind for her life. Pat didn't become a stewardess because she was seeking adventure. Life up to this point had been far from boring. Her parents had moved the family from town to town, state to state, her entire existence. She was born Patricia Ann Gibbs in Cincinnati during World War II. But if she had been born 2 weeks earlier, she would have been Patricia Ann Goldberg. In 1942, Goldberg was too Jewish for a town like Cincinnati, which had more than its fair share of German sympathizers. So Bob decided they needed a new name. The family didn't get to choose for themselves. Instead, the courts chose for them. And so Gibbs they became. They left Cincinnati, though, In part because...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?